His story is woven into the rest of the story of the last week of Jesus' life. I'll read only parts of it to you from Matthew 26. It's about the growing plot of conspiracy against Jesus, beginning on page 1542. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas. And they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. "But not during the feast," they said, "or there may be a riot among the people." The story picks up down in verse 14 that then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asks, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" They counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. And then a couple of pages later, the story picks up in verse 47, that while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Friend, do what you came for." Millions of babies over the centuries have been named after biblical characters: Adam and Eve and Abraham and Isaac, David and Mary, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Timothy. Even Caesar has a salad named after him. But not Judas. Judas has no one named after him. No pets, no places, nothing named after Judas Iscariot. And yet he had such a very good beginning. It all started back when Jesus was drawing large crowds of people, and Judas was counted as one of the thousands that thronged around Jesus. He saw that Jesus was smart, that he spoke as no man had ever spoken, that he was supernaturally powerful. Thousands came from everywhere, hoping to see him, hoping to touch him. But Jesus had a little bit different strategy. Instead of dealing primarily with the crowds, he intended to select a dozen in whom he would significantly invest his life for the next 3.5 years. And so one day he walked away from the crowds. He spent an entire night in prayer to culminate a process that he had been in for a long time. He was going to choose which would be his 12. He considered all the possible candidates. He asked God for wisdom. And when he came down from his all night on the mountain, he invited 12 men to be his special friends and his disciples. One of those invitations went to a man named Judas from the town of Iscariot. He seemed interested. He seemed committed. He seemed to be a very religious man. Along with Simon, called Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, John, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thaddeus, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas, they all said yes. They were days of wonderful excitement and promise. Jesus poured his life into them. They understood the Bible as he explained it like they had never understood it before. They were at the very front and the center when the crowds pressed around Jesus. They were in the celebrity circle. They were eyewitnesses when Jesus actually walked on the top of the lake water. when he made those who were born blind able to see and those who could not walk so they could get up and run. They could even watch as Jesus raised the dead back to life, and Judas was there. They were wonderful days, and that was the very good beginning. But Jesus was more than a teacher. He also ran a small business. There were contributions that were made. There were expenses to be paid. And it is true that some people then, like now, feel uncomfortable with the business side of religion, but it was a necessity. And so we see that 13 men traveling around for 3.5 years, while not a large business by modern standards, was a significant enterprise in first century Palestine. And so Jesus, wanting his business to be run well then, as he does now, needed a trusted treasurer. He needed someone who was dependable, someone who could keep good records, someone who had a good business savvy about him. What he wanted was someone who could handle the business side so that the ministry side would be further enabled to be effective. He chose Judas. He seemed like a good choice at the time. Judas had talent. He was already part of the circle. He could be trusted. And so the decision was made, and Judas was given the money. He would handle it. But please don't think that Jesus merely used Judas as a business manager. He loved him. Now, of course, Jesus loves everybody. That's what Jesus came to do. And Judas is included in that everybody, but more to it than that. Judas was close by. He saw Jesus' gentle glance. He felt Jesus' tender touch. He knew all about firsthand and close up Jesus' forgiving spirit and special attention and loyal friendship. Oh, it's always a good thing for anybody to experience the love of Jesus. But it must have been particularly powerful to be loved by Jesus for so long and so close. Judas never needed to doubt that he was trusted and that he was loved. But he wanted more. We have no record of the day when the thought ran through his mind that he could personally profit from the treasury that had been entrusted to him. My best guess is that one day, with one finger, he dipped into the treasury and he took maybe one coin. He assumed that it would never be missed. He thought probably that it made sense, although he had twinges of guilt about him. He would have explained to us that he was the chief financial officer of this organization, and it was his responsibility to determine the priorities, and he decided that his priority exceeded the priorities of others. He figured that it wouldn't make any difference. He figured that he wouldn't get caught. Actually, it's really quite hard to know when Judas decided to betray Jesus, if it was an early decision that he deliberately pursued, or if he really thought that what he was doing was the right thing to do. I suppose you could argue it from a lot of different angles. You could say Judas was the greediest man that there ever was. That when he could profit, he went to the temple police, he struck a deal. They said they would pay him 30 coins of silver. He would tell them a good time and a good place. He would set Jesus up and they would take him away. By the way, that's really not very much money. 30 pieces of silver. There are some scholars that say that a piece of silver would have the value of about 25 cents, or one of our quarters. So if you take 30 pieces of silver, or 30 silver coins, it would be like $7.50 was the price for the conspiracy against Jesus. Now, of course, selling out for money is nothing new, and ultimately, it really isn't the price that determines the deal. But Judas, his price was really cheap. But maybe it wasn't greed at all. Maybe he was simply disillusioned. He had these dreams, maybe fantasies of what Jesus would do. Judas was a political animal. Almost everybody was in those days when Rome occupied Palestine. They had high hopes that Jesus would take a strong political stance on the current issues, on the issues of economy, on the issues of leadership. They expected that he would use his spellbinding ability to speak, to capture audiences, to turn crowds and maybe incite an insurrection. That he would use his supernatural abilities to fight off armies and to defeat a far greater foe. And he was disappointed. Disappointed that Jesus did not do what he wanted to have done. And so, after giving it a 3.5-year try, he quit. Why bother investing any more of your life into this Jesus? He's not going to do it anyway. Might as well turn him in and make a small profit in the process. Or maybe we should give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he wanted to force Jesus into action. He assumed that Jesus was rather timid and reluctant to use his astonishing powers for political purposes. But if Judas could give him a push, maybe then he would do it. Judas decided to give him a shove so that if he was arrested, then he would be face to face with the religious and the political authorities. Jesus would have to use his supernatural power. It would speed everything up. It would make the dreams come true. Actually, none of these were adequate reasons for what Judas did. Selling out anyone for money is wrong, especially Jesus. Judas took on himself things that were not his to do. He was not in charge. These were not his choices. He had no right to call the shots for Jesus. What he did was flat out wrong, although I suppose it made some kind of perverted sense in the mind of Judas from the town of Iscariot. Twisted thinking led to terrible behavior that brought about a tragic ending. Judas met with the temple police. He told them that there was a garden. They called it Gethsemane, and it was there that Jesus would often go. And he went there at a time when there weren't many other people there. And so that would be an ideal location for an arrest. There wouldn't be a crowd. There wouldn't be a riot. There wouldn't be much political risk. If they went at night, there might be some question of whether they would recognize Jesus, although they knew his face well. And so Judas proposed that he would go with them, and then he would walk up to Jesus and identify him by kissing him. That way they would not arrest the wrong man. They would not risk any greater political damage than what they were already embarking upon. So it was all set. And then to cover his tracks, Judas went to the Passover meal that evening. He went and made things look as ordinary as he could so that no one's suspicions would be aroused. Nobody else sensed it, but Jesus did. For he not only loved Judas, but he also knew him very well. He saw what was coming. And although it is always a difficult thing for anyone to confront someone whom you love, Jesus did what he had to do. And he warned Judas that he was about to make the most foolish mistake of his life and warned him against it. He tried to stop him. But Judas had some kind of perverted sense of honor. He assumed that because he had taken the money, that he had a contract, and it was better to honor the contract and to betray Jesus than to somehow break the contract. And you know the rest of the story. Judas excused himself early. He met up with the temple police. They walked to Gethsemane. Jesus and the others showed up just as Judas predicted that they would. Judas directly walked to him, kissed him. He was arrested and tried. convicted, and sentenced to death by crucifixion. And then at last, Judas realized what he had done. He was horrified. Horrified by his own treachery. He was filled with remorse. He wanted to call the whole thing off. He took the money. He went back to the temple. He went to the police and the authorities. And he said, I've made a terrible mistake. I've sinned. I've sinned and I have betrayed an innocent man. And they said, hey, so what? Too late now. That's not our problem. That's your responsibility. Gripped with remorse, Judas took the money. He tossed it to them and said, I want to reverse everything that's happened. Run the projector backwards. For here, this man who had so much promise was now left with nothing at all. He didn't have Jesus. He didn't have the money. There was no going back. Distraught. Desperate. Guilty. Alone. He went out and hung himself. Oh, can you imagine how different it could have been? How different it should have been? Perhaps he might have written one of the Gospels. Maybe in the index of our New Testament, it would say Matthew, Mark, Luke, Judas. Perhaps he could be remembered by history as Saint Judas, a patron saint of all who could be trusted with other people's money and other people's things. Perhaps one of the most common names that for 2,000 years Christian parents would have given to their children would have been Judas from Iscariot. How different it could have been. How different it should have been. Oh, I hope you are not like him. I hope you hear his story and you do not identify with him. And yet I recognize that there are many, many men and women of modern times whose story is Judas's story. Only the names are different. The betrayal, your betrayal, may have been of a friend who really trusted you. It may be a betrayal for money, for which you are responsible. Or the betrayal of marriage vows. Or the betrayal of parental responsibilities. Or the betrayal of a coworker, a boss, or an employee. Maybe the betrayal of Jesus all over again. For those who consider betrayals of others, learn from the story to count the cost in advance. For what seems so simple at the front end can be so disastrous and tragic at the far end. For the cost of betrayal spins out on everyone, including you. So before breaking a word, before turning against a friend, before breaking a promise or ending a marriage or abandoning Jesus, realize that it is more than the wrong thing to do. Realize that the price can be high, and the price can also be yours to pay. You remember the story of the frog who comfortably got in the kettle, and then the flame was lit and the temperature increased by just a degree or two. And the frog barely felt the increased temperature. But then slowly, over a period of time, the temperature was raised and raised and raised until eventually the water bubbled and boiled and took the frog's life. At the end, the water was so hot that no frog would ever have gotten into it. But somehow, incrementally, it changed, and that which the frog would have run away from in the first place ended up being precisely where the frog's life was lost. The same is true with sin. There may be uncomfortable little theft of a small thing that incrementally grows in temperature and size until it becomes the embezzlement of a large amount of money. Or what begins as a small selfishness can slowly turn into a tragic betrayal of someone else who trusts and loves. But I think that the saddest part of Judas' story is the way he gave up hope. He simply could not believe that Jesus could ever love and trust him again, not after what he had done. He just could not see any way out of the mess that he had made. But do you remember when he went to Jesus and kissed him? What was the first word that Jesus said in response? He called him friend. I think the problem with Judas was that he never really knew Jesus. Oh, he listened to him, he saw him, he was part of the staff, but he never had a personal love relationship with Jesus Christ. He was just there, he just hung on with everyone else. So that while others were calling him Savior and Messiah, and while others were committing their lives, if indeed they had to die for Jesus, the best that Judas could ever come up with was to call him Rabbi. Hey, listen, I don't know what you've done. Maybe you've sinned terribly. Maybe there are other people who would call you Judas. Maybe you're thinking about giving up. Maybe suicide has actually crept onto your secret list. Please listen. Let me tell you. Don't give up. For no matter what anyone has done, Jesus still stands there with his arms open wide and says, friend, friend. But what if you are not the betrayer, but the betrayed? Someone you love deeply has hurt you. Someone you trusted with all your heart, completely ripped you off. Someone you believe in turned against you. The pain can be very great. In fact, just my suggesting it here in a public setting may not so much recall the memories as recall the emotions. The feelings come back to the surface again, and not even years of time seem to be able to heal that hurt. I wish I could tell you that I understand, but you know, that would really be insulting. For the pain is too great for someone on the outside to say, yeah, I know what you mean. I understand. But Jesus does know. He's been there. He trusted and he was betrayed. He loved and he was attacked. He was betrayed with a kiss. So take comfort in his understanding that you are not alone, and consider his example of how to respond, how to deal with that kind of betrayal that can turn life upside down, even inside out. For you may have no control whatsoever of what another person does to you. And so you can be betrayed by a husband or a wife or a parent or a child or a coworker or a friend or a church. It can happen anywhere. While there is not control over that, there is control over the choices that we will make in response. We can choose, if we like, to allow that betrayer to sustain power over the rest of our lives. We can choose to let the acid of resentment and hatred just drip inside of us until we are full of it. We can center the rest of our lives around the wrong that another has imposed upon us. Or we can be like Jesus. We can choose to be like him who loved when he was hated, who answered betrayal with friendship, who set himself to continue on the course that God had before him, which was a cross, but not to be torn to the left or the right by the behavior of someone else. But most of all, the way to respond to betrayal is to remember, like Jesus, that the outcome is up to God. I'll tell you that when I think of it, I can hardly imagine anything worse that Judas possibly could have done to Jesus. It was a terrible thing to do. And yet God used what Judas did to clear the path straightway to the cross where Jesus died, paid the penalty for our human sin, died and rose again and guaranteed for those who believe eternal life in heaven with God. Wonderful. Well, does that mean then that what Judas did was really a good thing? Of course not. But it does mean that God can ultimately use that which is the very worst to accomplish that which is the very best. So when you are betrayed, no matter how bad it is, be like Jesus. Answer hatred with love, betrayal with friendship, and be convinced that God is the God who can take the worst and make it into the best.
Each Sunday morning, the faith story is someone from the Wooddale Church family telling either about coming to faith in Jesus Christ or sharing that faith with others. Steve Younger comes to tell us about both of those in his faith story this morning.
As a child, my mother instilled in me a belief in God. She always saw to it that we went to church, prayed in our home, and recognized God daily. However, when I started college in the early 70s, I withdrew from the Lord and eventually turned my back on Him completely. By 1986, I hadn't gone to church for years, and I lived as if God didn't exist. I didn't think I needed God. I was doing pretty well on my own. My career was going unbelievably well. I was a top sales consultant in my industry. I was living in Northern California in a beautiful home, been married for 10 years, and I had two wonderful children. From the surface, everything looked ideal, but I really wasn't happy. A check of my priorities will tell you how far off base my thinking was. First, there was my career in making money. Next came my leisure time, then my wife and children. God wasn't even on the list. Even though I felt at the time that I had a successful marriage, there started to be problems. The problems escalated, and soon my marriage was in serious difficulty. I asked a neighbor who I respected what was wrong with my marriage. She mentioned something about a spiritual battle. I remember shaking my head, walking away, and wondering, what was that all about? Little did I realize that she was a committed Christian. And the next day, she gave me a book called Love Life. Described the biblical prescriptions for a healthy marriage. When I got to page 240, I was in for the biggest and the most important change in my life. It was November 15th, 1986, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I can still remember exactly how I felt. Knowing that my life was now an incredible mess, I realized for the first time that I couldn't do it alone. I needed help. As the tears started to flow, I read the words on page 240, which said, I believe that Jesus Christ died on the cross for my sins, and that by rising from the dead, he demonstrated that he was God, and that if we believe in him, we can have eternal life. Come into my life, Lord. Help me and change me. After I prayed, I felt a peace and a calm come over me that was just total and complete. I'd never experienced anything like it. I had hope, and I knew that whatever happened, it would work out okay. I began to read the Bible daily. I got involved in a good Bible-based church, and I started to grow in my faith. After a six-month separation, I got back together with my wife, and our marriage was the best it probably ever was for about a three-year period. My career was still going very well, and things were much more in balance. However, Since all my extended family was here in Minnesota, I felt God wanted me to be here. So I sold my house, moved cross country, and used all my savings to start a new business. That's when my faith in Christ began to really be tested. Not long after returning home to Minnesota, my mom developed skin cancer. Cancer was very aggressive, and her condition worsened quickly. Around this time, my wife decided that she wanted out of the marriage, and we divorced. I was now a single parent raising a 14-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter. The business was struggling financially also. Then the stress on my mom's illness basically caused my dad to have a heart attack. And during Christmas 1992, I thought I was going to lose both my parents at the same time. While my dad recovered and he got out of the hospital around New Year's 1993, my mom was getting worse much rapidly. While my family gathered at my parents' home in January 1993 to watch the Super Bowl, I was able to sit with my mom and read the Bible. My mom certainly believed in God. She had always gone to church, but I really wasn't sure if she had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. I started reading through the four spiritual laws and kept looking at her to see what her reaction was. By this time, her cancer-racked body was so weak she couldn't talk. I asked her if she wanted to pray with me. One of her eyes just winked ever so slightly, and I said, "I'd pray aloud, and you can pray silently to yourself, Mom." I read aloud the same prayer commitment I had used 7 years earlier, and then I looked up and asked my mom if she had prayed with me. Her eyes literally twinkled and danced. With about all of her strength, she squeezed my hand. I looked into her eyes. I just cried for joy. They were not only tears of happiness, but tears of victory. That's my definition of Super Sunday. My mom died the next week with all the family around her and with a quiet peace in her heart as she went to be with the Lord. That was 3 years ago, and reflecting back, there were days I honestly didn't think I could make it. Through all this, though, God was strengthening me. The vehicles he gave me during this time was the love and support of my new Christian wife, Deborah, my children, Jesse and Tracy, my Wooddale Bible Study group, and my dad, brother, and sisters. Today, I'm attempting to set my priorities where they should be, and that means my relationship with Jesus Christ is first. I've learned that God will always be there for us. He'll not give us more than we can handle. We can use the problems we encounter to deepen our faith if we place our hope in the Lord.
Lynn, I'm glad we had lunch. It's good to have a friend I can talk to about things here at work.
When will you tell everyone?
Oh, not yet. I'll spring it on them at the last minute and make them regret passing me up for that promotion.
You know, they took a big risk promoting you last year. Don't you feel like you're deceiving them by not disclosing your plans?
Absolutely not. I am clearly being blackballed, but they'll pay for it.
Well, look, if I don't talk to you before you leave, good luck in your new job.
Lynn, what are you doing here?
Oh, hi, Kevin. I just had lunch with John.
Oh, he seemed a bit crabby this morning. Hopefully you cheered him up.
He's decided to resign.
Oh, man. Because he didn't get the promotion?
Isn't it obvious? He thinks he's going out in a blaze of glory, leaving you all to twist and die in his wake.
I wish I didn't know this. Now I have to act as though I don't know. Say, I thought you guys broke up. Are you back together again?
No. He leads me on to believe he wants a serious relationship, and just when I tell him I'm ready for a commitment, he says he only wants to be friends. I just wish he'd stop calling me. It's like he's humoring me or something, and it's getting to be really annoying. Well, look, I've got to go. Call me later, okay?
Okay, bye.
Hey, is that Lynn?
Yeah, she and John went to lunch.
I thought he dumped her.
Apparently, he wants to stay in touch.
Are you still mad at her for asking John out?
I'm not mad, but he is my boss.
And she's your best friend.
Yeah, I just wish she would have talked to me first. I mean, she met John one time through me, and then suddenly 10 years of friendship just flew out the window. I felt betrayed.
Yeah, that is awkward. You can't dictate her love life, but now you have to maintain a professional relationship with him while being a confidant for her.
Well, not for long. Lynn said John was planning to quit. Apparently, he's going out in quite a huff.
He's been talking about quitting for years. I can't believe he'd finally go through with it. But if he is, I'm going to be really hurt that he didn't have the decency to tell us about it. We've been putting in a lot of extra hours for him.
Uh-oh, here comes that human resources rep. She's been hounding me about my benefits claims. I gotta go.
Hi, Sydney.
Hi, Rachel. Hey, I heard about the award. I can't believe you withdrew your name. But what the heck, you won it last year, and most people never get one.
The Annual Achievement Award?
Yeah, you were a lock. But your boss said that you told him to withdraw your name. I think that was a really noble thing to do.
John said that? That traitor.
You mean you didn't?
Well, it's too late now. Besides, he's resigning.
John's quitting?
I heard he's pretty bitter. The scary thing is, he's the only one that has access to the mainframe right now.
Well, I'm going to have to report this to computer security. You know they're always concerned about maintaining the integrity of their system. And as insulting as it is, usually the only way to handle a situation like this is to have someone just escort him out. I'm going to need about half an hour. You won't say anything, will you?
Oh, not a word.